Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
From Dartmouth Hitchcock, imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
And from Granite State College, offering diverse bachelor's and graduate business degree programs online. Designed to help working adults advance. Granite State College, where quality matters. More information and registration at granite.edu.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Earlier this spring, two murders and a suicide took place on Facebook Live, videos seen by thousands before Facebook took them down. And these were just the latest disturbing scenes. But while it's easy to condemn those who conduct these acts and publicize them, what's the responsibility of those who watch and do nothing? These digital bystanders seeing terrible harm done right before their eyes. And speaking of responsibility, how about the companies who provide the platforms for this material? Facebook, Periscope, Twitter, and others. Today in The Exchange, who cares about cyber ethics and who should care? Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. We have three guests with us. Joining us from Dartmouth College is Hani Farid, professor of computer science at Dartmouth and a senior advisor to the Counter-Extremism Project. Hani Farid, really nice to have you. Thank you for your time.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
Also with me in studio, Nora Draper, an assistant professor of communication at UNH and a member of the Prevention Innovations Research Center at UNH, where she works on the role of bystanders online and in social media. And Nora, thank you very much for being here as well.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
And also with us, Leah Plunkett, associate professor of legal skills at UNH School of Law and a fellow at Harvard's Berkman Kind Center for Internet and Society, where she studies the digital lives of young people. And Leah, good to have you too. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Laura.
Well, and Leah, I want to turn to you first, but hear from all of you. It's pretty grim when you think about what some people will do and then post it, and other people will actually watch it, even share it. And there's always been crime. There's always people, you know, doing horrible things to others. But to do these things live online, as if to say to the world, hey, look what I did. I just wonder, Leah, how you even begin to sort through what that means.
I think, Laura, that you start from a place of realizing and accepting just how digitally connected our lives are at this point. So my Fitbit tracks my steps, my phone tells me where I have to be and when, right, with my automatic reminders in the morning. And so I think just accepting that the technology is embedded into every part of our lives. And from there, thinking about governance approaches. My senior colleague at the Berkman Klein Center, Urs Gasser, has spent a lot of time having us think about what toolkits we have available to try to solve these problems. So we can look at laws and regulation as a toolkit. We can look at the market as a toolkit. But most important, I think, we can look at human-centered solutions and a toolkit that involves educating ourselves and others to accept this digital connection, but use it in a way that's based on strong values and a consistent conversation.
Well, and this next question, you can say, I don't know. Okay, it's a perfectly acceptable answer. But this is what I wonder about so much, Leah. Someone who is, you know, twisted enough to commit a murder and put it online, which is what we saw earlier this spring, would that person have committed the murder anyway? Or was the excitement of, again, in a very twisted way, was the excitement of, I'm going to put this on Facebook Live and all these people are going to see me do this. Would they have done it anyway? Do we really know?
I don't think we know, Laura, but I think that we can make an educated guess that there is an element of thrill an element of insta-celebrity seeking that comes from the digitally connected aspect of our lives. And for most of us, again, that digital connection may have some minor problems around the edges, but fundamentally helps us, right? Again, I want to know how many steps I've taken. I want to get an alert from Amazon Prime when my package is on my doorstep. But certainly for folks who have mental health issues or aspirations to commit wrongdoing, I do think that there's a way in which the digital connection enhances the platforms available to them and might well push them over the edge.
What do you think about this, Hani? You have studied, you know, this from the perspective of child pornography. Now you're looking at terrorism and extremist groups. What do you think about that question that I just asked, Leah?
I think that's a really good question, and it's the right question to ask. I think the reality is we don't know. We don't know what's in the mind of these people. But I think it's reasonable to assume that the knowledge of being able to distribute this worldwide is an incentive. And that is very worrisome when the social media platforms are inspiring these types of acts, because they give people a platform that they've never had before. And I think that's exactly what we are worried about. And trying to understand how the social media platforms can do something about that, I think, is the key question.
Well, and I know you've looked at that a lot, Hani, and we'll definitely get into that for sure. You know, what responsibility, if any, some of these companies have. But a little bit more, please, on the word you chose, Hani, inspire. And I think we're having some trouble with Hani's connection, and I do apologize to you, Hani. Nor, I'd love your thoughts, too, on this question. And again, as I said to Leah, I don't know was a perfectly acceptable answer.
That's right. I agree with both Leah and Hani that I don't think we know why people engage in these types of behaviors. Certainly, a lot of the status metrics, the things that allow us to understand and track how many views we're getting online, how many likes we're getting, how many shares the things that we post get, have the possibility to excite people, both when they post things that we might find pro-social, but also when they post more problematic things. So I think one of the things that we need to think about is how those status metrics, the likes, the shares, the retweets that we get can potentially drive certain types of behaviors.
So let's draw that line a little bit more. And it's a tough one. I mean, obviously, there's a chasm of difference, Nora, between posting stuff, you know, like there's a site, Epic Fail, that one of my kids liked to watch. He thought it was really funny. You know, you watch people trying to leap over the hole in their dirt bike and they don't make it. Ouch, Epic Fail. Or they try to jump over the super high fence and they don't make it. Ouch, Epic Fail. There's another site that one of my other kids watched, watching people eat increasingly hot, spicy chicken wings. OK, and every time it gets spicier, you know, the person sweats a little bit more and says, wow, 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 it's spicy. So that's, you know, some people think it's funny and they laugh. Is there a line between those types of sites that attract people and some of these more sort of antisocial behaviors?
I'm not sure that there's a clear line between those behaviors. But what I would say is the same types of excitement of having people watch, having people witness your behaviors occurs kind of regardless of the types of material that we're posting. So if somebody might be excited by being able to share, you know, this hot wings eating competition or the spiciness of their hot wings, someone else might be excited to share a poem or, you know, a picture that they've taken. And so it's I would hesitate to draw a direct line between those things. But I think that the metrics we have for seeing how much our content online is being watched and liked and shared by other people has the potential to really excite us and drive particular behaviors.
Do you want to jump in?
I think that the line is indeed very hard to draw because we are getting increasingly conditioned, especially our kids from a very early age, to think about our personal private lives as performative almost all the time. Right. So this gets back to the digitally connected, seamlessly interwoven ways in which we use digital technologies and share data about ourselves. So you have kids, very young kids, saying, you're going to post that picture of me you took to Facebook? How many likes did it get? My son, who's six, who, when he gets his screen time, loves to watch other kids play with toys on YouTube Kids. And as a professor, I'm often thinking, gosh, I wonder where the market mechanism is there, right? I wonder how much the child who's performing is getting paid to inspire my son to play. But especially once we have this idea that everything we do can be tracked and shared, I very much agree with Nora that what your internal value system and psychology and network is might be very determinative about what you see as being exciting to share, but we're all sharing and we want to share.
Give us a little bit more, Leah, on the word you use, performative. For listeners who, you know, maybe aren't on the internet that much, who have never looked at Twitter, aren't on Facebook. I mean, I know what you mean about performative and net metrics, but just describe what that means for someone who isn't as familiar with this realm.
Sure, Laura. So we have, through social media platforms, as well as just the more direct person-to-person text messaging and email, the ability by picking up your cell phone, or in my son's case, occasionally trying to steal my cell phone and shooting video of me, which fortunately he can't upload yet, but he has done that. We have the ability to record our private domestic moments and broadcast them. So to draw out the YouTube example for a moment, you get families who seek celebrity status on YouTube, which is an open platform for sharing video content. And so these families will just broadcast clips of their doing everyday average stuff and try to get followers and likes and maybe convert their followers to a commercial enterprise where they're getting paid by products or services to promote those products or services. But it really can take a turn. So I believe it was the Washington Post earlier this spring reported on a family that had a huge YouTube following, but the parents were playing practical jokes on the children to the extent that some viewers felt uncomfortable.
Like what?
They contacted Child Protective Services, so basically setting up the kids to have tantrums or feel sad. And the family has stopped broadcasting on the YouTube channel and has issued a statement saying that they're seeking help. So kind of trying to trade off the child's emotionality around being tricked and exposing that to tens of thousands, if not perhaps hundreds of thousands. I can't quite remember what their follower base was. But folks around the world who can sit there for free in the comfort of their own homes or, you know, in the doctor's waiting room looking at their handheld and just watch this child have a meltdown over something that his parents set up.
Wow. So creating family dysfunction so that your YouTube channel will get more views.
Correct.
Upsetting your child on purpose so that your YouTube channel will get more views so that you can then get advertisers so that you can, again, make money.
Correct.
I'm just struck by that. And so that has been taken down.
That particular family site, I believe, yes, they took down.
Okay. I want to ask our listeners what they think. And then we have so much more to talk about. Again, the exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Again, the number, 1-800-892-6477. Today in the exchange, we're looking at cyber ethics and whether that word really even exists, whether there are any sense of ethics or morality online, and also the digital bystander. We're looking at how today we can live stream anything through platforms like Facebook Live, turning us all into potential celebrities. But as we're also hearing, it can go too far with a rising criminal acts posted. 1-800-892-6477 is the number. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And Hani Farid, I think you're back with us. So I did want to turn to you again, and I do apologize for any technical difficulty. I'd love for you to draw the line as well, Hani, that our other guests have drawn, saying maybe you shouldn't draw it too strongly. The line between people posting stuff that they think is interesting, maybe a little edgy, and some of the, you know, crimes that we've seen.
Yeah, I think this is the right question to ask, is how do we find a balance between wanting to share and have an open and free exchange of ideas, even if those are sometimes troubling, and then how do we mitigate the harm of some of the worst things that we are starting to see online? And as we've seen over the last few months, the tech companies, Facebooks and Twitters and YouTubes, are really struggling with trying how to define inappropriate context. And I don't have great answers for that. I mean, we have some technological solutions that deal with sort of the worst of the worst. And so there's clearly content where most reasonable people can agree this has no place on the internet. Shootings, child pornography, extremism, etc. And there's other content we can all agree we have no problem being on the internet. And the difficulty is there's this middle ground that is very tricky to deal with. And it gets even trickier when you think about the fact that social norms are very different across different countries. So this is not just a U.S.-based issue. This is an international issue. So what we would consider to be edgy in another country may not, and vice versa. And how we deal with this at internet scale, at a scale of a billion uploads on Facebook a day, at a scale of hundreds of hours of YouTube videos a minute uploaded every day, is really, really complicated. And I think one of the difficulties here is over the last two decades, we have driven full steam ahead into the internet. We have adopted technology. It has gotten integrated into our lives. And we have not stopped to really think very carefully about the implications and how we control this. And so here we are now dealing with this massive, very complicated problem without really having had the time to think very carefully about it. And so we are reacting to it now. And that raises technical issues, legal issues, ethical issues, social issues that are incredibly intertwined and very difficult to deal with. So I think we have answers to some of them, but I think there's a lot of questions that we don't actually have really good answers to, and I think we have to start thinking more carefully about what we want the internet to be in the years to come.
Well, and I'd love to talk to all of you about how the companies have responded to this, the companies whose platforms are used to present these acts, suicides, murders, and so forth. And in April, Mark Zuckerberg at Facebook's developers meeting commented on the murder of Robert Goodwin by Steve Stevens. Stevens presented his crime on Facebook Live. Let's hear how Zuckerberg addressed this.
Our next focus is building community. We have a full roadmap of products to help build groups and community, help build a more informed society, help keep our communities safe. And we have a lot more to do here. And we're reminded of this this week by the tragedy in Cleveland. And our hearts go out to the family and friends of Robert Goodwin Sr. And we have a lot of work, and we will keep doing all we can to prevent tragedies like this from happening.
Okay, so, Hani, I know you've thought and written a lot about the responsibility of companies. How satisfying is that? We have a lot of work to do, and we're going to keep our communities safe.
Yeah, I mean, the problem with that line is we've been hearing that line for many, many years. We have been hearing that line from Facebook. We've been hearing that line from Twitter and from YouTube and from Google. And the reality is that nothing makes these companies move to protect the online communities except legislation, advertising dollars, and bad press. The reality is left to their own devices, these companies are not interested in moderating and removing content. It's not in their self-interest. And what I've seen over the years, from the child pornography issue to the extremism issue to the criminal issue, is that the company's press release always tell us how seriously they take this. They always tell us how important it is. But when you look at the action on the ground, what they are actually doing, how much effort are they putting into this issue, it is fairly pathetic. And it's not until we start to threaten legislation, it's not until advertisers flee en masse from these platforms, do these companies finally turn around and say, okay, we have a problem, we have to do something. So I think it's too little too late, and I think that the actions have not caught up with the press releases.
Well, and Hani and others, after a short break, I want to ask everybody, okay, so let's say Facebook and Twitter did everything in their power to shut these things down immediately. Wouldn't this just pop up somewhere else? We'll talk about that in just a moment and start taking your calls, too. You can join us, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. We'll be right back.
Okay, so how do trees fare in times of drought?
Well, it depends on the tree type.
This week on Something Wild, Chris and Dave get some professional help.
Climate change forecasts suggest that in the future, although we'll likely experience more total rainfall, we're also expected to see more frequent and severe droughts.
Don't miss this week's or any week's story. Subscribe to NHPR's Something Wild wherever you get your podcasts.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, digital bad behavior and the rise of the digital bystander. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. We had three guests, Hani Farid, he's a professor of computer science at Dartmouth College and senior advisor to the Counter-Extremism Project. Also with us, Leah Plunkett, associate professor of legal skills at UNH School of Law and a fellow at Harvard's Berkman Kind Center for Internet and Society. And also with us, Nora Draper, an assistant professor of communication at UNH and a member of the Prevention Innovations Research Center at UNH, where she works on the role of bystanders online, in social media. One more time, the exchange number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And all of you, let's go to our listeners. And Tim is from Portsmouth. Hi, Tim. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning, and thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
While I was calling in, I noticed that the conversation shifted from the social media users to the social media providers.
Sure.
And the last comment from your guest virtually echoed what I had to say about the issue. And so I'll just paraphrase a little tiny bit of my discussion, and that is that the whole thing, social media, is not an altruistic experience in sharing. It's all about generating clicks and money. And the overall problem is there's a theme here. And the theme is that elite schools like Tuck, the Dartmouth, have not taught business ethics for 40 years. They don't miss out on teaching people in their elite business schools the difference between illegal and legal, but they have failed us. They have failed our society on teaching people the difference between right and wrong.
Well,
so your guess was 100% correct in that these people, the internet providers, are not going to do anything. It's not an ethical challenge to them until they start to lose money or are regulated.
Well,
so
Tim, thank you so much. Yeah, and
thanks.
Thank you. And echoing what Hani said just before the break, that he sees efforts from companies as pathetic, and as our caller says, it's all about clicks and likes and money. What do you think, Nora?
Well, one of the primary ways that companies have kind of tried to regulate this behavior in the past is through the flag, right, which is often an icon that we see across social media sites that is designed to do a lot of heavy lifting. It asks users to basically flag content that is outside of the community norms of a particular platform. But as Hani said, while these community norms differ kind of globally, they also differ from platform to platform, and it's not always clear to the users what kind of fits within or outside the community norms of a particular platform. So, you know, in my research, when I talk to users about how they use these kind of flags to indicate problematic content, one of the things I often hear is that they don't know what happens when they flag content. They feel that potentially, you know, something gets flagged and they never know, is it taken down? Is the user notified? Is the user banned? And it's not necessarily clear to them that they've kind of flagged content that really is deemed inappropriate. Sometimes they're told that the content that they do flag doesn't rise to the level of kind of an issue that the site would actually deal with. And then perhaps most perversely, sometimes these flagging tools can actually be used to target minority voices on a site. So for example, kind of content that doesn't conform to particular gender norms. So this this system, this sort of flagging system that asks a lot of users to kind of police the content happening on these websites has been a tool that companies have used, that platforms have used to try and regulate behavior. But what I see often is that users are kind of trying alternative forms of regulation within these sites when they find that those tools aren't particularly effective.
Well, I definitely want to ask you about that, but a little bit more on the flagging, please, Nora. So let's say I see something that I think is, you know, really racist. you know, on Twitter or Instagram, and I flag it, like, who am I flagging it to, and what do they do with my flag? Maybe they say, no, Laura, that's not racist. You just have no sense of humor.
Right. So how a site, how a platform would deal with this is going to vary depending on which site we're talking about. And one of the problems is that that's not always a transparent process. So particular sites have put in place a kind of mechanism for tracking content that you've flagged. So you might be able to see down the line what has happened. Has that been taken down? Has the user been notified? Have they had their privileges curtailed in some way? But oftentimes that deliberation process is not visible to the user who flags the content. So there's a sort of lack of transparency around how sites are dealing with this type of problematic content that kind of, I think, has the potential to stop community deliberations where there actually might be a way to say, you know, here's the type of content that we as a community on this site deem appropriate or inappropriate.
And we've talked a lot, maybe I'll turn to you first, Leah, on this program before about, you know, First Amendment and shutting down speech. That's not really where I want to go with this show today, because there have been all these disturbing incidents. Again, we've seen, you know, rapes, murders, suicides. I mean, you know, it doesn't get worse than that. You know, beheadings. I mean, how do you see companies attempting to manage that material, which, you know, just about everybody would say, no way should that be presented on Facebook Live or whatever?
I think companies are trying to be proactive in terms of detecting and removing content that squarely falls into the category, Laura, that you're talking about, that I think we would all agree is criminal and threatening and has no place in our public square. Building off of what Nora said, a lot of these platforms, especially social media, are today's public square. And I think you do have companies saying that they are going to step in for content that all of us, you know, if we saw it happening in the middle of Bicentennial Square, would immediately call the police. As a lawyer, I think less about threatening legislation and more about legislation as, when done well, a thoughtful part of the shared toolkit we can use to try to help companies, users, and other stakeholders understand what those outer boundaries and limits are. So building off of what Hani said, do I think that there's increased room at the state and ideally at the federal, given how interconnected this is, level to have more clear guidelines through regulation and then more clear bottom lines through legislation that companies have to follow? Sure. But I think that companies' efforts with the kind of content you're talking about, the Beyond the Pale content, maybe haven't done everything we want yet, but I actually think that they are more than pathetic. I think that they are engaging in good faith in a realm that is rapidly changing for all of us.
Can you really, Leah, regulate or legislate the internet? It's so huge, as Hani said. And also, Hani pointed out that it isn't just the U.S., it's global.
So,
I mean, is that just really, you know, not even possible?
It's not possible as the only toolkit to use. But if you look again at sort of different governance toolkits, so we make laws and accompanying regulations, we provide human-centered solutions, which would be education and community norms. We provide technological fixes, like Hani was talking about earlier, where companies have better software and sort of machine learning to find this content and maybe take it away automatically. So it is certainly not the only toolkit, Laura, but I think it's an important one.
Well, again, the number for you to join us here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange at NHPR. NHPR.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. So, Hani, let's talk about that. What role can technology play in counteracting these downsides of technology that we're talking about?
Yeah, I think, so first I want to take a little issue with the company's responses. So let me just give you a couple of examples. In 2003, we saw a growing and troubling amount of child pornography being distributed online. The then Attorney General Ashcroft called in the major tech companies and said, your platforms are being used for some pretty horrific things. These were 12-year-olds and 8-year-olds and 4-year-olds and 3-month-olds being violently sexually molested. And then the platforms were being the avenue in which this material was being distributed around the world. Between 2003 and 2008, with pressure from the White House, the tech companies did absolutely nothing. They spent 5 years talking about how serious the problem was and wringing their hands and saying, we think this is horrible, but there's nothing we can do. In 2008, myself and a researcher and engineer at Microsoft, in collaboration with the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, developed a technology within a year that is now in worldwide distribution that filters out tens of millions of child pornography content around the world. And so we're very good at our jobs, but there's no way you can believe that the tech companies could not have done something in that five-year gap. Now, fast forward to today, one of the pressing issues online is extremism. Extremist groups, both domestic and foreign, have weaponized the Internet. We know this. We have been hearing about this for years. Just last month, the EU released a report that said when tech companies are notified of extremist content, the takedown is less than 50%. So this is not even about being proactive. This is law enforcement agencies that are finding content online, reporting it to the online platforms, and the platforms half the time are doing nothing.
And why is that? What's the reason that they give?
Well, that's a really good question, and I don't have a good answer for that. One of the reasons they give is we get a lot of reports, and we're overwhelmed with that. And, you know, my answer to that is, well, you don't seem to have trouble hiring engineers and advertisers to make a lot of money, but somehow you have trouble hiring people to deal with the negative consequences. The moderators on Facebook have 10 seconds on average to review a flag report. You're obviously understaffing that space. And I don't buy the story that these multi-billion dollar companies with billions in profits can't ramp up that effort. I think they can. I think they just choose not to.
How easy or hard is it, Hani, to make something disappear once it's out there? The example you gave, you know, 50% of the time it isn't, but 50% of the time it is. Yeah. And you have obviously superior technical knowledge to me, but it seems like once something is, you know, videoed, put online, maybe Facebook takes it down, maybe Instagram takes it down, but it just seems like it would pop up somewhere else. I mean, if you really want to get your, you know, heinous video out there, you'll get it out there.
Well, the answer is yes and no. So, for example, in the child pornography space, we have Facebook and Microsoft and Google and YouTube and Twitter and Dropbox, and we have hundreds of companies around the world that deploy this technology such that when we find a child pornography image, we extract this distinct signature that allows us to find that image on any upload in any contributing online platform. So that allows us to eliminate it from the vast majority of mainstream platforms. Now, does that remove it from the Internet? Of course not. So now we go into the dark web, we go to peer-to-peer sharing, we go to end-to-end encryption, and so the problem moves. But that's not a failure. That doesn't mean we shouldn't act. If we can take away extremist content and child pornography and the other horrific content from the mainstream online platforms, that is a success. If we can keep narrowing and narrowing and narrowing the space in which this content lives, that's a success. And so I think to say, well, we can't eliminate it, so why bother, I don't think is the right argument. I think there is real value to that. And by the way, the law enforcement will tell you the same thing. If the space they have to search and police gets smaller and smaller and smaller, that is a success for them.
So if this content is put before, you know, 50,000 eyeballs instead of 100,000 eyeballs, that's a success.
We've moved the needle. Have we solved the problem? Of course not. But that's the way the solutions are going to look. They are going to be incremental. But here's what I also know is that without the pressure from legislation, advertisers, the media, public relations, competitiveness, the needle won't move. The companies are going to do what the companies do. That's okay. I understand that. And that's our role in the media as legislators and advertisers and as consumers to ask more from our online platforms, to ask them to really create a safe space, not just say they want to create a safe space.
Okay. I want to ask both of you, too, what you think about that. But let's go to our listeners for just a moment. And Chris is in Nashua. Go ahead, Chris. Thanks for calling in. You're on the air.
Hi. Good morning, Laura.
Morning.
I work in a tech field. I have two young children. They're six. And, you know, what we intentionally do here is we have kept them off the Internet. We don't give them tablets. We don't want them in any way to have their brains kind of wired around technology and the gamification and the instant gratification that a lot of these platforms embed in their, you know, in their user experience. We want them to grow up kind of like with an organic understanding of relationships and morality in the world around them. And to distinguish between what's real and what's not. And so, you know, unfortunately, I think has been mentioned earlier, you know, this technology is here to stay. It's not going anywhere. So unfortunately, the burden falls upon the parents with no help from these tech platforms to kind of help them understand, you know, the way to deal with this. And, you know, I feel like sometimes we're kind of putting the burden where it doesn't belong, but unfortunately, that's where it ends up. The other thing I wanted to say is, you know, it's my understanding from conversations with peers as well as people, you know, what I've read about Silicon Valley, a lot of these executives do what I do. You know, they understand the nature of the product that they actually produce and promote. And so I feel like we should take a lead from them and kind of, you know, not basically not deliver these children to these platforms. Where
yeah. Well, how old are your kids, Chris?
6.
Okay, yeah. So I can tell you it gets tougher as they get older, but I really appreciate the call. And it's interesting what he said. I did read recently that Steve Jobs and other very prominent Silicon Valley executives do not let their children have, you know, iPads and so forth, at least when they're young. So that's interesting. Going back to what Hani said about, you know, companies have financial incentives to make their sites attractive. They spend, you know, billions and billions on advertising and coming up with new ways, and not nearly enough, he said, to police what is happening. What do you think, Nora? What can we reasonably expect from companies to do with their sites? And where else does the burden fall to create these safe communities that Mark Zuckerberg keeps saying he wants to create?
Yeah, so one of the areas that we look at Prevention Innovations Research Center is tools that companies can offer to individuals, to what we call active bystanders, to actually engage when they see content online. And, you know, I think we think a lot about active bystander, and I think a lot of us are probably familiar with the idea of active bystander intervention in a kind of offline heroic capacity, where somebody physically puts themselves in the middle of an altercation to stop a fight or to stop an assault. But one of the things that the program Bringing in the Bystander, which is out of Prevention Innovations Research Center, tries to get people to think about is the much maybe more mundane or everyday acts of intervention that we can engage in to stop situations from escalating.
Online?
Well, let's start offline.
Sure.
So, for example, kind of maybe intervening when you hear harassing or discriminatory language being used to stop a situation from escalating, turning on the lights at a party or offering someone a glass of water if you feel like something maybe is about to happen or could happen. And I think, you know, one of the things that's complicated to think about is what those intervention efforts might look like online. It's not always clear what the digital equivalent of turning on the lights at a party might be or offering someone a glass of water is when we think about the digital context. And one of the other kind of difficult things about intervening online is that often what will happen is somebody who kind of tries to intervene to stop a discriminatory conversation that's happening, they might actually turn the attention of the perpetrators onto themselves. So there can be a real kind of hesitation, I think, to intervene online if people feel that the consequences might be that they themselves become the victims or targets.
Right, and you have trolls saying, you know, I know where you live, watch your back, and that's terrifying for people. Lots more to talk about in just a moment. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, cyber ethics and the digital bystander. The Exchange number for you to join us with your comments, questions, concerns, 1-800-892-6477. Send email to exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Again, 1-800-892-6477. So all of you, we've been talking about, again, the people who create this content. And as I said earlier, if you're just joining us, there have been murders, suicides, you know, child abuse, all sorts of stuff being shown, sometimes live, on platforms like Facebook Live. We've talked about the people who create that content, why they might do so. We've talked about the responsibility, or lack thereof, as Hani Farid says, by the companies. Let's talk more about the people who just watch it. And Leah, I'm so interested in what Nora said just before the break. What is the online form of someone turning on the lights at a party where it's getting a little dangerous, or jumping in to, you know, push someone aside who might be ready to hit someone? What's the online version of that?
I think that there's no one-size-fits-all online version of that. And I think one of the key things to keep in mind, because of the seamlessly connected way our lives are with technologies at this point, the online version of that might be an offline behavior. So to give a concrete example, I heard from a teacher recently about being contacted by students saying that someone else in their class was talking about self-harm and actually posting some pictures on a social media site. And the students, rather than trying to digitally engage, took an active bystander role of contacting the teacher directly and saying, "We're seeing this and we're scared." And the teacher did the common sense thing of picking up the phone, calling the parent and saying, "I'm hearing about this right now. Where is your child? Find your child, make sure your child is safe, and then we'll keep talking." And the child was found, the child was safe, the child is receiving care. But I think recognizing that even before we start itemizing sort of particular interventions, that responding to digital content might require some quote-unquote brick-and-mortar behaviors as well. Now, the students seeing this content that their classmate was posting certainly could have also sent messages of support, right? So instead of liking the content or sharing it, could have written, you know, "Please call me. I want to make sure you're okay." You know, suicide prevention hotline number, right? But I think that's an instance where actually the best form of being an active bystander for this digital concern was actually an offline, good old-fashioned person-to-person response.
So that's a great story. It raises another question for me, though. What about an instance, Leah, and what's the responsibility of the bystander in an instance where, let's say I'm sitting here in Concord, New Hampshire, I happen to go on Facebook, I happen to go on Facebook Live, and I see that situation in Ohio. I mean, my goodness, that man being murdered on Facebook Live. I mean, I'm not there. I can't do anything about it. What's my responsibility?
I would say don't watch it. I would say if there's any doubt in your mind about whether law enforcement knows, notify law enforcement. But I would say don't put your eyeballs on it. Don't like it. Don't share it. Don't screenshot it for future use unless you're a researcher in the space or law enforcement in the space. But essentially, don't give it the digital currency of eyeballs on the screen.
And that's easy for you and me to say because we're not sort of people who, you know, maybe grew up in this era of,
sure,
you know, it's all about the, wow,
sure,
look at this, wow, look at this, wow, sure, look at this, look what so-and-so posted. Oh, my gosh, it's kind of what we talked about earlier, you know, the culture of look, 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 and look at my stuff, and look how many clicks and likes and so forth. So it's easy for us to say that because we're adults, but it's a little different for another generation.
And I think this is where, and I would love to hear Nora's insights on this, but I think this is where providing digital literacy, digital citizenship, and other types of curricula starting as young as kindergarten, if not earlier, and I'm with Chris, I severely limit.
You have a six-year-old as well.
Right,
like
exactly.
Yeah.
But I do think there has to be a point where we do start teaching children about their digital lives, because inevitably they will intersect with their brick and mortar lives, and better for them, the same way I grew up, you know, in the 80s and 90s hearing about just saying no to drugs, we need our kids to be hearing certain consistent messaging around their digital lives.
Digital citizenship.
Correct.
I don't think they're offering that right now in most public
We've got
schools,
some resources.
But so before you jump in, Nora, I did want to ask you, Hani. So again, I love the example that Leah gave us. You know, there was some concerns of some online comments of this girl made. Her friends jumped in. They notified the teacher notified the parents, and there's a happy ending. But what about if you come across, you know, harmful criminal content and you have no idea where it's happening? Do you have any responsibility?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really good question. I think we have to take control of our internet communities, and I think that is going to look like in many different ways. So that means the legislators have to start controlling things, The companies have to start controlling. We, as the participants in these spaces, have to start taking more control. So I think everybody has a responsibility here, and no one solution is going to solve all of our problems. I completely agree with Leah and Nora that we have to start teaching at a very young age what does it mean to be a digital citizen. I actually think that is very important. Here at Dartmouth College, I can tell you that the students don't fully understand, well, they don't understand their physical lives, and but they certainly don't understand their digital lives, and it is very complicated, and we're being thrown into this without a lot of guidance. And I think at the end of the day, it's coming down to parents saying, look, I'm just terrified of you being online, and so I'm going to keep you offline. And we have to take notice when Steve Jobs won't let his kids use an iPad and be online. That should be worrying to us. And I think we have to start taking this very seriously, because I think, again, we've been thrown into this digital era without really thinking a lot about what the ramifications are. And I think the time is now to start looking at all aspects of that.
Well, speaking of Steve Jobs, Apple CEO Tim Cook spoke about this, the whole idea of cyberethics, digital citizenship, when he spoke just recently at MIT's graduation. Let's hear.
There is so much out there conspiring to make you cynical. The internet has enabled so much and empowered so many. But it can also be a place where basic rules of decency are suspended and pettiness and negativity thrive. Don't let that noise knock you off course. Don't get caught up in the trivial aspects of life. Don't listen to trolls, and for God's sake, don't become one.
Again, that's Apple CEO Tim Cook speaking at MIT just recently. What do you think, Nora, about what Tim Cook said and also that phrase that Leah just said, digital citizenship?
Yeah, I think digital citizenship is a really kind of important idea, and I think it's sometimes easy to fall into a trap of kind of thinking that young people, you know, don't care about privacy or want to share every aspect of their lives or aren't concerned about, you know, their online footprint or digital tattoo, as we sometimes hear it called. But in my conversations with young people, one of the things that I find is that they're actually very actively engaged in these issues. They're very sophisticated in certain ways about what their identity looks like online. You know, they use multiple different platforms to kind of display different parts of their identity, some that are visible to their friends, some that are visible to their parents, and some that are visible to employers. So they do have a digital sophistication in certain areas. And one of the ways that I see that is in the ways that they use tools offered by platforms, not necessarily those flags, but other tools to actually engage in a kind of community regulation. So, for example, some sites will display content depending on how many upvotes or downvotes that particular content has received. And so one of the things that users can do is actually help curate what that site looks like through their own voting behaviors. And so I've talked to young people who either kind of as a group or individually will go online and spend a little bit of time sort of going through a site and actually trying to influence the type of content that they see through these mechanisms, which are not necessarily intended by the platforms to help to eradicate or disrupt discriminatory content, but are actually being used in that way by communities of users. And I hesitate to put too much responsibility on the part of individuals or on the part of communities to police this content. I think that has the potential to absolve platforms of the responsibility that they have, and I don't want to do that. But there are ways, I think, in which we can potentially have some hope that young people in particular are actually engaging responsibly in these types of conversations and using tools that we might not even imagined for this particular purpose to engage in this type of bystander behavior.
What is the responsibility, if any, of a remote bystander? I use this example with Leah, again, the murder on Facebook Live in Ohio recently. If I'm sitting here in Concord, New Hampshire, and I just happen to see that, I'm not looking for it, what's my responsibility as a bystander, as a digital bystander, you know, X hundred miles away?
Yeah, I think I would echo what Leah and Hani have said, which is, you know, if there's any question that this is content that, you know, hasn't been that the police haven't been alerted, that's a really good step to take. But I think it's at those extremes where it's very clear, right? I mean, if you see the types of content that you're talking about, a murder being committed online, a rape being committed online, I think those are often situations where we know that we should flag the content, not watch the content, you know, alert the appropriate authorities. It's often in what I think Hani described earlier as a kind of gray area where we don't necessarily know if this behavior fits within the community guidelines. You know, is this speech discriminatory? Are these behaviors problematic? And that's when I think, you know, we have a bit more work to do around education.
And is it real, Hani? I mean, how do we know if it's real or not?
Yeah, that's the right question to ask. And so, you know, in the physical world, we don't have to worry about that. We see something bad happening and we act. But here's the good news is that if you respond to something and it's not a bad act, there's very little harm done. I mean, notifying the online platform, notifying law enforcement is the right thing to do. I'll also add, in the child pornography space, if you find child pornography, you are mandated by federal law to report it to NCMEC, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. So in some spaces, there is legislation that dictates the response of private citizens and corporations and how they do that. And there is legislation that is being considered here in the U.S., in the EU, and in the U.K. to start to regulate the Internet. We heard Prime Minister May, after the London attacks and the Manchester attacks, say Internet companies are not doing enough. We need to start forcing them and forcing the people on these platforms to be better citizens. And so it is not out of the question that this is going to start getting legislated in the coming years.
What types of remedies do you think Prime Minister May is seeking, and would they work?
Yeah, so, you know, it's hard to read between the lines, but some people are saying that she is advocating for an end-to-end encryption that allows people to communicate completely securely online. That is, I understand the position that the UK has. That has some people in the civil liberties concerned because end-to-end encryption allows us to talk, for example, with the dissidents. There is no doubt that she wants the tech companies to do more about removing recruiting videos that have allowed extremist groups to weaponize the Internet. So right now, it is very broad. In Germany, for example, they are considering fines on the order of $25 million for each time a tech company does not respond to a takedown notice. Civil liberties groups are concerned that that will have a chilling effect on speech issues because will the companies then just start taking things down overly aggressively to avoid these $25 million fines? And so the legislation is not a cure-all because now what's happened is we've waited a long time to respond, and now we are overreacting in some ways. And so there's a middle ground there that we need to find between balancing a free and an open Internet, to have vigorous debate with people we disagree with, but drawing the line for certain types of content. And that's going to be the tricky thing to find, both at a technical level, but also at a policy level.
Well, and speaking of speech, Hani, correct me if I'm wrong, private companies, you know, again, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, whatever, they are allowed to restrict speech, right? I mean, or are
that's
they?
Exactly.
I don't know.
The First Amendment doesn't give you the right to post things on Facebook or YouTube or Twitter. The First Amendment says that the government shall not impede on your freedom of speech. And so the companies already do this. So, for example, Facebook says you are not allowed to have adult pornography. Apple says there are no apps with adult pornography, perfectly protected speech. So the companies are absolutely allowed to do this. The concern from civil liberty groups, and I don't necessarily share this, but I will echo it, is that companies like Facebook and Twitter and YouTube are so ubiquitous and so global and so common that they essentially are limiting speech on that is limiting what somebody's rights. I don't necessarily agree with that argument, but that is the argument we are hearing when we hear about moderating some of the worst content. And of course, the companies, you know, at the end of the day, have to worry about competition. They have to worry about advertisers. They have to worry about legislators. They have to worry about social norms that are different across the world. So they are, in their defense, juggling very complex issues. I don't think that means we should throw our hands up and say, well, we can't do anything about it. I think we just have to navigate that space thoughtfully and carefully.
Well, and Hani, as you said, they could spend a little less on advertising and a little more on policing some of this stuff. I wonder what you think, Leah. Have there been any attempts to hold companies liable for, you know, extreme antisocial behavior that happens on their platforms? Are there sort of duty to rescue laws? Hani talked about duty to report when it comes to child pornography.
So there certainly are at this point various private causes of action that individuals could choose to try to assert against social media companies, keeping in mind, as Nora and Hani have already talked about, that privacy policies, terms of use, and terms of service that we all click on all the time without
even though
reading
no one reads them.
Even,
yes.
Exactly. We have researchers say no one reads them, are going to set up the parameters of those. And mostly they'll start with arbitration. So best of luck to the user. It's probably not going to go very far. We do have the Federal Trade Commission that can step in if it is seeing an unfair, deceptive act in practice. So a company that is either not abiding by a commitment that they've made to their users. And so companies that sign on to something like the Student Privacy Pledge, for instance, that is a very popular pledge that hundreds of companies have signed on to in terms of how they handle youth data. If they are found not to be abiding by that commitment, you could see regulatory enforcement coming in. But in general, in tort law, and I'm not a torts expert, but there are very few circumstances in which we have a duty to rescue as private individuals, even in the brick and mortar world.
Well, and last quick question for you, Nora, and it comes from a Facebook comment from Madhab. And Madhab, I apologize, I'm going to have to shorten it. Mahad worries that all of this is making new generations less compassionate. Seeing things like this online, right in your face, you know, a rape happening online. What do you think?
Well, I certainly hope that that's not the case. And I think as we've talked about, this idea of understanding what it means to be a digital citizen is a large part of this kind of new landscape. Understanding what it means when we share something, what happens when we choose to share something, and how even the best motivated intentions may not have the consequences that we wish that they would. So I hope that it's not the case that people are becoming less compassionate. And in my conversations with young people, I don't see that.
Well, Mahab, thank you for the comment. And all of you, thank you for being here. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.